Humbles versus Bus. Mr. Schechter?
Good morning. Brad Schechter on behalf of Petitioner Appellant William Humbles. I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court. There are essentially two key facts in this case. Number one, Titus Larkin, the victim, is the only person that is able to tie Mr. Humbles to the shooting. There are no other eyewitnesses that testified that Humbles shot Larkin, and there is no physical evidence such as fingerprints, DNA, a weapon, bullets, casings, that were recovered and admitted into evidence and that placed Humbles at the scene. Number two, when Larkin was previously involved in a similar situation and complained of being shot, he lied to the police about the circumstances of that shooting on at least three occasions, falsely blaming others when in fact he had actually shot himself. The jury, however, never heard this second fact, and this is ultimately the poison that taints and infects Mr. Humbles' entire trial. In particular, Humbles' attorney committed four fatal, outcome-determinative flaws that I want to focus on this morning. First, his attorney failed to investigate the details relating to Titus Larkin's prior arrest for false informing. Second, he had then failed to confront and impeach Larkin with those details at trial. Third, Humbles' attorney allowed the state to improperly vouch for Larkin's credibility during closing argument without objecting or otherwise rebutting that vouching. And fourth, Humbles' counsel promised a witness and defense during his opening statement that ultimately he could not deliver. Humbles' attorney's failure to find out the critical...
I thought it was that he promised that the defendant would take the stand.
He did. He promised that Mr. Humbles would take the stand and provide an alibi and testify on his own behalf. That's correct. Humbles' attorney's failure to find out the critical impeachment evidence in this case, the one crucial witness that effectively could tie Humbles to the scene, ended up convicting Humbles before this trial even started. Had his attorney had knowledge and the details of Larkin's false informing charge, those four aforementioned flaws likely would not have occurred. The prosecution's entire case rested on Larkin's testimony and thus his credibility. The state in its brief does not dispute this, nor do they substantially challenge any of the legal arguments presented by Humbles. Under Strickland, an attorney's performance violates the Sixth Amendment if the conduct falls below an objective standard of reasonableness and if the substandard performance prejudices the client. Prior to trial, the state turned over 43 pages of discovery. One of those pages put counsel on notice that Larkin had a prior arrest for false informing. None of the discovery, however, went into the details of that arrest. It is objectively unreasonable for an attorney to hear that the one and only witness that can link his client to the shooting has an arrest for false informing, but to not ask a single question or do anything to try to follow up and find out the details of that arrest. This is not a high standard we're asking the court to hold counsel to. Humbles' attorney had one duty to perform, and he failed to perform that single duty.
Well, the record shows that Larkin eventually implicated the defendant's brother in that crime, right?
That's correct.
And the brother gave Larkin the sawed-off shotgun and went with him to shoot at somebody for revenge. If the jury had heard all those facts, it would have seen that Larkin had lied about the prior shooting, but wouldn't it have found out that Humbles had another motive than to shoot Larkin? So why wasn't that a permissible strategic choice for counsel to not get into that? I mean,
I think there's two points there, and I'll try to take them one at a time. To begin with, for there to be a strategic choice, his attorney had to actually know the details.
Well, didn't his lawyer say he didn't recall whether he investigated, not that he didn't investigate?
Well, there are three bases in the record for why the record shows that his lawyer did not know that have those details. The first being Humbles' testimony in post-conviction, which states that his lawyer first found out after trial when the prosecutor, I guess, shook his hand and said, "It's a good thing you didn't delve into those details," almost taunting Humbles and his lawyer for not doing so. But if you look at the record itself, there were 43 pages of discovery that were turned over. That's what was turned over by the state. None of those pages detail those list those details. His attorney did not affirmatively do anything either. If you look at the half sheet or the case management sheet, there's no motion filed for additional discovery. There's no subpoena served. There's nothing. There's no you know, he didn't do anything. And his affidavit actually, I believe, states that he does not believe. That he did not believe that the prosecutor provided the details. His affidavit states that he does not recall much, but he did not believe that the prosecutor provided the details.
How much leeway is allowed in Indiana to cross-examine anyone on their prior criminal record? I know in Wisconsin you're only allowed to ask if you've ever been convicted of a crime, a felony, and if your answer is yes, how many times, three or four, whatever it is, but you can't go into the details underlying that conviction. That's the law in Wisconsin. Now, what is it in Indiana?
Sure. Indiana Rule 608B is strict like the Wisconsin rule that you reference. And by its letter, and as the state will argue, I'm sure, and point out, by its letter, it does not allow a witness to be a witness to be cross-examined about specific instances of issues that bear on a witness's truthfulness, and reliability, and the Indiana Appellate Court indeed in its decision found that there was no prejudice in this case for that reason under the theory that the evidence would not have been admissible, but that ruling is an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law and mandates habeas relief here for a couple of reasons. Mostly being that the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment must necessarily trump that rule.
So the rule limiting impeachment to have you ever been convicted of a crime and how many times and stopping there is violative of confrontation rights under the Sixth Amendment?
Your Honor, in actuality here, Larkin was never convicted of the crime. This was an arrest. So it would fall under 608B and not 609A.
The rationale would be less leeway if there's an arrest than a conviction.
Understanding that, but the Sixth Amendment and the Confrontation Clause demands that in situations precisely like this case, where we have one witness that links and can tie Humbles to this crime, his credibility is the entire case. I mean, if counsel can't challenge his credibility, there's nothing. His lawyer didn't put on any defense. No witnesses.
And so you would say that overrides the rationale for the rule, which is to not conduct many trials on, like, arrests or even on convictions. I mean, the whole reason, the premise behind the rule is not to get into all of those details because you end up on a tangent trying that case.
You're
saying the Sixth Amendment trumps that.
Absolutely. And by way of authority, I point to two United States Supreme Court cases, Holmes versus South Carolina and Davis versus Alaska. In both our cases that have required state courts to admit evidence that would otherwise not be admissible under the state evidentiary rules, because barring such evidence would deny the defendant his constitutional guarantee of presenting his key theory.
Those cases are not dealing with the precise issue we're talking about here.
They do not deal with Rule 608B, no, but they do deal with other state evidentiary rules.
Yeah, but this is a evidentiary rule that, and in habeas, we're not supposed to upset a decision unless it's clearly contrary to a clear directive from the Supreme Court. And I don't know that the Supreme Court has ever said that this limitation on how impeachment evidence of prior convictions is to be used is violative of the Confrontation Clause.
Well, Your Honor, I do think that those two cases are fairly analogous. In Holmes, it was evidence of third-party guilt that was central to the defendant's defense. And in Davis, it was evidence of a juvenile record that would not have otherwise been admissible under the Alaskan evidentiary, under Alaska's evidentiary rules. And in both cases, the Supreme Court found that the defendant would not have been able to put on his defense without that. It's not as if we have other evidence and other testimony in this case that goes to impeaching Larkin's credibility. This is what we got here. And his lawyer's failure in the first instance to even investigate and develop and try to even make a record and try to use it, and perhaps the trial court says no under 608B, but at least make the record, the appropriate record, to develop it for direct appeal, that in itself is ineffective assistance. By failing to even do that, and in Williams versus Washington, this court commented on the ability of trial counsel to investigate that, and perhaps that, if he investigated that, perhaps it would have led to other admissible evidence, such as other witnesses that could testify on Hummel's behalf, also, perhaps, you know, there's some evidence of bias that could be developed there that would have otherwise been admissible. And under the federal rule of evidence 608B, this evidence also would have been admissible. Just by way of example, two cases cited in our reply brief, Varhol and Reed, are both examples of federal courts allowing a party to use prior false statements or acts of dishonesty during cross-examination to attempt to cast doubt on the witness's reliability for telling the truth. His lawyer didn't even try here, and it's really not conceivable that the trial judge wouldn't have let this evidence in. This, considering it's the key evidence in this case, had he at least tried. Finally, the impeachment evidence certainly would have become admissible once the prosecutor opened the door to it and improperly vouched for Larkin's credibility during his closing statement. The prosecutor argued to the jury regarding Larkin that, and quote, he seems like a very likable young person, he seemed very credible, end quote. And then he later implied that there was, you know, no reason why Larkin would lie about Humble shooting him. Well, there was a reason. I mean, he's done it before. He has lied about being shot, and he has falsely accused others. And while Humble's attorney should have objected to this vouching in the first instance, he certainly, had he had investigated, done his due diligence, done his job, and known about this evidence, he certainly then would have at least objected, maybe moved for a mistrial, or at least at that point in his own closing, used it to rebut the prosecutor's statement. And in fact, in his closing, he doesn't say anything about Larkin's credibility.
Mr. Schechter, at the time of the shooting, were there other witnesses that spoke to the fact that Larkin had identified Humbles?
Yes, Your Honor. There were, in addition to the responding officer at the scene, there were two other non-police witnesses, Curtis Davenport and Keisha Hassan, I believe was her name. Davenport was outside at the time of the shooting, and he was able to testify that he was shot, but he didn't see who shot him, and he wasn't able to make an identification. All he saw was an arm reach out of a car. Hassan was inside the house during the time of the shooting, and she was just able to testify that as he laid there, he said, "William Humble shot me," sort of an excited utterance type situation. This was New Year's Eve. All these individuals were together in the house at a party. There was drinking going on. There's evidence in the record that Larkin may have had, you know, shots of brandy throughout the night, a couple beers. Everyone had been drinking. One of the partygoers, the whole reason this apparently started is because one of the partygoers had to be dragged to her car because she couldn't stand up straight. Obviously, while his lawyer did attempt to impeach those witnesses' credibilities based on the drinking, he didn't impeach Larkin's, and that's the key witness in this case. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so thank you.
Martin.
May it please the court. The Indiana Court of Appeals quite reasonably rejected these claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, and the district court accordingly, correctly denied habeas relief in this case. The underlying theme of Mr. Humble's arguments as he's raising them now before this court and on habeas review really fails to acknowledge the universe of facts that surround this case. Not only did Mr. Humble's counsel render effective assistance, he actually did a remarkably good job based on the facts and circumstances that he was faced with.
How about this representation in a two-day trial that he's going to testify?
Your Honor?
I mean, I'm trying to recall the last time we were confronted with that kind of statement in a closing that fell so short at the mark, that's all.
His opening statement announcing that Mr. Humbles would testify that he had an alibi.
It's a dramatic change overnight. I don't know. But
that is also explained by the record, Your Honor. Initially, Mr. Humbles was the only person that would have provided any kind of alibi testimony. That's made clear by the record. There are colloquies and discussions among counsel and the court that disclose that there were, in fact, a list of people who had been alleged or thought to have some alibi testimony, that investigating police officers had checked those out, and that none of them actually provided a real alibi. And it's clear from the record that Mr. Humbles' counsel was aware of that. The state was aware of that. So Mr. Humbles was the only one that could have purportedly have given some alibi testimony. When Mr. Skidinski, counsel for Mr. Humbles, gave his opening statement, there had been a colloquy with the court and counsel in which the court had rendered what the court considered a ruling in limine with regard to what could be disclosed about the 1992 robbery for which Mr. Larkin and Mr. Humbles had both been convicted and had committed together. Now, at this point, I believe that Mr. Larkins had already testified, and he had already been impeached with having been convicted of that robbery, as well as having been convicted for false informing, which was not, in fact, the case. It had not been reduced to a conviction, but the jury still heard that he had, in one fell swoop, been convicted of a robbery and of false informing in the past. So he had been impeached with these things. Mr. Skidinski was successful in keeping the jury from ever hearing anything of the sort about Mr. Humbles. Now, had the jury heard about the 1992 robbery conviction for which they have both been convicted, the court later, after this ruling in limine and after Mr. Skidinski had made his opening statement, clarified his ruling in a way that Mr. Skidinski could not have reasonably anticipated, where the judge clarified that if, in fact, Mr. Humbles took the stand, that that was going to be fair game. It was going to be opened, the door was.
I understand that, but I thought defense lawyers never tell a jury an opening statement that you're going to hear what my client has to say about this. You're going to get up on the stand and testify. I thought that's just about something you never say because you don't know. And what can happen here, maybe it was a strategic choice not to put him on the stand, but once the jury's heard that promise, that creates a problem, doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor, it obviously didn't work out as Mr. Skidinski had thought it would, and it may have been the wiser choice to not make that announcement and just present Mr. Humbles at the appropriate time. But I think that he had a good basis from his discussions with the court to think that he was going to be able to allow Mr. Humbles to testify. And what the court had said was that he would confine any discussion about any feelings or interactions between Mr. Humbles and Mr. Larkin to the fact that they had a grudge. I want to point out to the court that this claim of ineffective assistance of counsel was never raised in the state courts. They did not argue that counsel was deficient.
I noticed that the Indiana court didn't discuss that issue, the question that Judge Flom had, or the one I'm following up on about promising that you're going to hear from the witness.
Yeah, it wasn't alleged as a deficiency, and he didn't allege that he had been prejudiced by that in the state courts. Yeah. So that's why the Indiana Court of Appeals didn't address it, Your Honor.
Okay. And do you have any cases that say because that to me is one of the most troubling things about the case, the fact that he made the promise, then he didn't get to. Do you have any authority that says that's appropriate or any case law you can shed some light on that issue?
Your Honor, I would just base it generally on the examination of counsel's performance and whether it prejudiced him.
I didn't see any real cases that either side addressed on this point.
I don't know of any that bring up facts that are squarely analogous, Your Honor. But the bottom line is that the last thing that Mr. Skidinski would have wanted to do in this case was to flesh out the facts surrounding the false informing and inform the jury and make the jury apprised of all of the background that was at issue in this case. With respect to the 1992 robbery for which Mr. Humbles and Mr. Larkin have both been convicted, Mr. Larkin's belief was that Humbles blamed him essentially for him being convicted in that matter and that that was the motive for Mr. Humbles shooting Mr. Larkin. To open that can of worms, as it were, Your Honor, and then also add to that knowledge that Mr. Humbles' brother had similarly been what they considered snitched out by Mr. Larkin builds a pretty impressive motive. And Mr. Skidinski's strategy for this litigation, or for this criminal trial, rather, was clearly to let the jury reflect on what was not presented in the evidence here. And there was a strangely absent motive for this crime. And there was no testimony other than that the two had had some form of a grudge or some kind of a beef, if you will, from the past. And for the jury to simply speculate about that could lead them to believe that Mr. Larkin was, in fact, the initiator of what happened here based on his grudge towards Mr. Humbles. So Mr. Skidinski was able to put this case in front of the jury without the jury being aware of any of this extremely damaging baggage that Mr. Humbles brought into this prosecution with him. And as my opponent alluded to, there were questions that the jury had to answer that the evidence did not answer. And that was the theme of the closing argument that Mr. Skidinski gave. And I think that everything that he did in the conduct of the litigation shows that that was his strategy and was very effective in helping him execute that strategy.
I just have one question about this photo array. The prosecutor emphasized with McQueen that the photos had been taken from police files. McQueen said that once, and then the prosecutor asked the question again. What was the reason for that, bringing that out a second time that they came from police files? Other than to try to get in the back door that he had a record.
Your Honor, I will say this. I don't believe that the record would support that was being intentionally attempted by the prosecutor. I do not recall the specific questions that elicited the responses, but my recollection is that they were isolated and fairly brief and were unintentional. I think that with regard to counsel's performance in that respect, it was certainly not unreasonable for him to decline to draw additional attention to that reference. The facts that I've just discussed with regard to this case make the universe of claims raised in this habeas appeal without merit. There are a number of attending procedural bars, which I'm sure that this court has already considered when reviewing the briefs. I can answer any questions that the court might have about those bars at this time. If not, I would just rely on the arguments that we've presented in our brief and would just simply conclude by saying that this was a tough case where you had a witness with a long history of familiarity with the charged offender, identifying him as a man who shot him. There was corroborating evidence to show that the shooting did occur. It is true that Larkin is the only one that can say, yes, it was William Humbles. But absent Larkin having some motive to lie, I want to restate that. Larkin, to the jury's satisfaction, would have had no reason to lie, and the only reason that he could have shown that was to get into the priors, which is going to show that Humbles had a much stronger reason to carry a grudge than Larkin's would have. And in fact, there really isn't anything to show that Larkin's would have had a grudge. To the extent that it would have shown that Larkin's is generally a liar, I think that it wouldn't have been very probative of that, given the actual facts that surrounded the prior false informing charge.
Well, and I have the language now. Back to the photo thing. McQueen had testified that the photos came from the police file, and then after that, he was asked directly by the prosecutor, where did the photos come from? And he answered, police file. So it was a very direct question.
Your Honor, that was probably not the best way to ask the question. However, I would also, though, point out to the court that Mr. Humble's photograph was one of those that was included in the raid that was clearly or that was not obviously a police mugshot or a photo, and that the court had taken or that the prosecutor had taken care to make sure that the photos as they appeared in the array did not appear to be mugshots or photos that were from an arrest or a conviction.
But police files certainly suggest that one was on file with the police for something, and it probably wasn't a good thing.
Oh, Your Honor, I don't disagree with that. If the court has no further questions, we just ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Shackney.
Counsel, I looked again at that post-conviction decision from the Indiana court, and there is no discussion of this promise that that Humbles would testify, and no allegation that that was a claim made in the Indiana court as a basis for ineffective assistance.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's unfortunate, and I wish it would have been raised below. However, I don't think that is necessarily a complete bar to arguing before this court today. In particular, in the Schlupp versus DeLeo, the standard is if you have new evidence, and in this case the new evidence is the details surrounding Larkin's prior arrest for false informing, and if that new evidence shows that it's more likely than not that no reasonable juror would have found the petitioner guilty, then the gateway, so to speak, is opened, and additional constitutional violations can be argued. And it certainly was a constitutional violation to promise that he would testify, not put him on the stand. And Judge Williams, if I can direct you to the United States Hampton versus Leibach case, which is cited in our briefs. And in that case, this court specifically did address a failure to put a witness on the stand. Stating that that gaffe alone may be serious enough to warrant habeas relief, the court observes a broken promise of this magnitude taints both the lawyer and the client on whose behalf it was made. I submit we would have a dramatically different trial if his attorney was able to impeach Larkin's credibility, didn't promise the jury that Humbles was going to testify and didn't put him on the stand, did his due diligence, investigated this case, and gave him a fair shake. And considering that this was a two-day trial, each of these errors then becomes magnified even more so. All these errors are in the fresh minds of the jury. And he just overall did not get a fair trial. A final point before I run out of time is that Larkin actually was not impeached, and the reason he wasn't impeached, even though he elicited that admission about a conviction for false informing, it didn't go into the details. He wasn't able to elicit that, you were previously shot once, is that correct? Yes. Did you previously lie? Did you lie to police initially about the circumstances of being shot? Yes. Did you falsely accuse others for that shooting? Yes. I respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's denial of the habeas petition. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schechter. All right, thanks to both counsel. Mr. Schechter, I want to convey on behalf of the court an additional thanks for your accepting this appointment and for your firm's support, obviously, in permitting you to aid the court as you ably have.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.